Welcome to My Warm Table. I'm Sonia Nolan, and season two of this podcast about passion and purpose is brought to you by Females Over 45 Fitness, or FOF, in Victoria Park.
My name is Kate Chaney.
My name is Bonnie Davies.
My name is Madeline King.
My name is Valerio Fantinelli.
My name is Lynn Beasley.
Hi, my name is Sharon Todd.
My name is Lucy Cook, and I'm the CEO of Space Drum.
I'm the first Aboriginal female funeral director.
I'm a psychologist and a professor in psychology at Curtin University.
You're listening on Sonia Nolan's My Warm Table.
Just sharing a yarn with her.
Electricity is undoubtedly one of the greatest inventions of all time. It's revolutionised our world in every aspect of our daily life, connecting all our communications, powering our homes, our workplaces, and now even powering our cars. I know we take it for granted. We flick the switch and everything we need just magically comes to life. Well, today we're going to stop a moment and think about how we are so connected to this incredible power source that we call electricity. We're going to honour the courageous and skillful men who climbed heights without fear to assemble and construct those tall steel towers which look like mini Eiffel Towers across our landscape. We're going to step back in time to 1951, when the Australian branch of an Italian company set up in Australia to connect our vast, remote country to a reliable electricity source which enabled a future of possibility and prosperity. Electric Power Transmission Proprietary Limited, or EPT, was that company. EPT holds an important chapter in Australia's story. The story of migrants making their way in a new land. The story of connecting Australia across a remarkable and unforgiving landscape. The story of powering Australia into prosperity, signalling the start of industry, new jobs and new economic opportunities. The EPT story brought the 1956 Melbourne Olympics to our TV screens. It linked Carnarvon to the NASA space program, and it was a pioneer of WA's industrial future, underpinning Alcoa, BP, Hammersley Iron, and even the Northwest Shelf. And for me, EPT is a deeply personal family story. It's a company etched with gratitude in the memory of my childhood. My father, Norberto Facin, joined EPT in 1958. During more than 30 years with the company, he built towers of power, fields of friendships, and his hard work, sweat, and fingerprints are embedded in many of the structures we know across WA's landscape. EPT turned on the lights for Australia, so it's only fair that we should shine a little light on it today. And to help me tell this story, I'm honoured to be joined by Matthew Quarmi around the warm table. Matthew's father also worked for EPT, and his paternal legacy inspired Matthew, an architect and passionate historian, to research and write a book about EPT and its communities. Matthew's spent the last few years sharing warm tables across Australia, piecing together the history of EPT with the pioneers of Australia's energy legacy, migrant men who are now aged in their 70s and 80s. Matthew spends several months a year here in Perth, away from his home in Victoria, to humbly pursue this passion project and capture these important stories, and I'm so delighted to have him join me today around the warm table. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you, Sonia.
This is such a deeply personal story for me, and I'm already feeling emotional, which is not a good start, is it, Matthew?
Both of us, Sonia.
But because it is a family story for both of us, can you tell me about your EPT connection?
Well, my father came to Australia in 1962 and started working for EPT. You know, his brother-in-law and his elder brother are already here working for the company. And that was his beginning of his life in Australia.
And it was sort of a typical beginning for a lot of migrant men from Italy, wasn't it, and Europe?
Yes. After the war, it was a safe island in a land where they felt like foreigners.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because that's something that I hadn't really connected. You know, we sort of read about World War One, World War Two, and 1945 was the end of World War Two. But, of course, things don't magically go back to normal after such a huge upset in any in the world, and we really need to cast our minds back to the late 1940s and 1950s, and it was a whole other time and era, and a time when things were being rebuilt, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah, and I guess that's where the story of EPT in Australia began.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me about, was it 1951?
EPT was established in Sydney in 1951. They won a contract to build a transmission line from the south of Sydney near Port Kembla to Sydney. At the time, Sydney was beset with blackouts and power rationing. So the construction of that transmission line was part of the government's effort to reinforce the electricity system for Sydney.
Mm. So what was there beforehand? Like, how were people getting their electricity to their houses before these power lines were built?
The electricity network at the time was broken up into different municipalities. So each council was producing their own power. The power line from the first one that EPT built started at a new power station that was built on the lake. On Lake Illawarra, and it was the beginning of starting to change the way they generated electricity. So rather than bringing the coal to the city and burning the coal there, they burnt the coal at the coal field and then transmitted the electricity to the city, and that had other benefits, environmental being one of them.
Yeah, right, I see. So definitely all coal-generated
yes.
power stations in those days
yes.
in the 1950s. And look, still here we are in yep. 2023 and still a lot of these power stations are coal-generated. We've got, you know, certainly an ambition in Western Australia now to turn, to stop the coal-powered fire station in Collie. That's, I think, being pushed out to, I think, 2024, 2025, but definitely the times are changing there, but gosh, coal was where it was at certainly for the last, you know, 70 years.
It was cutting edge technology at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was cheap, whereas now things have changed and renewables is the way to go. So.
Yeah. And it is a time of change now, but certainly in the 1950s, it was a time of change then, wasn't it? And we
yes.
are talking cutting edge technology, coal power. So tell me about some of the changes that were happening in the 1950s that really sort of set the landscape for EPT.
Well, being post-war and the government's policy, populate or perish,
yes.
To grow the economy was in full swing, and having a reliable power system was part of that. Australia didn't have the expertise at the time to build power lines. EPT was a subsidiary of an Italian-owned company that built high voltage transmission lines all around the world. So basically there was no competition for them in the beginning. Everything was brought out from Italy, including the steel for the towers.
Is that so?
Everything was brought into Australia. They had there was a concession for them to import steel without any import tax.
Well, they wouldn't have been able to make steel in Australia at the time, would they?
It was limited because they didn't have the power to run the power
plants. I was
going to
say, it's sort of chicken and egg, isn't it?
That's
chicken
right.
and egg. So, and that again brings us to how important this time and place was with EPT coming and setting the power stations up, because that then meant we could have all the industry that we're having today.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going to get to that. Certainly in Western Australia, it was an absolute, you know, the pioneer of things that allowed us to have Hamersley Iron Ore, Alcoa, BP, all these names that we all know now we rely on. Northwest Shelf,
yep.
exactly, which continues today. So all of those industries are underpinned by the work that EPT did.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. So tell me more about that time in 1950, because I believe there's a link between, and, you know, an interesting link between EPT and the Olympics in Melbourne in 1956. What is the connection there?
Well, EPT, when they started out, came to Australia with a group of about 100 men, and they started building that transmission line at the end of 1951. It was completed in 1953. And even though there was some foresight to expand into allied industries, they still weren't sure what was going to happen, how the company was going to evolve. big part of their decision to expand into Australia was the prospect of the Snowy Mountains scheme.
Right, yes.
Which had started, but the big power lines weren't being constructed yet. And so there was this gap between that first contract in the Snowy Mountains scheme and the initial project in Sydney. So they needed to diversify to keep the workforce busy. One of the first projects was a power station on the opposite side of Sydney on Lake Macquarie. They erected the steel for that power station in 1952 and 1953. But when the Olympics came to Australia, that heralded the start of transmission of television broadcast in Australia.
That's right. TV was just sort of starting, wasn't it,
the
early days?
That was the catalyst for it.
The catalyst, right, okay.
And they needed towers to mount equipment on there. And EPT was the obvious contractor to start doing that. So, the first TV tower built in Australia for broadcast was done in Sydney for Channel 9, and EPT built that.
Uh-huh. And, of course, then in order to be able to look at your TV in your lounge room, you need power, right?
That's right.
It's so chicken and egg, isn't it? Yeah. So, okay. So,
a huge opportunity at the time, and there was no other contractor with EPT's experience to do it. So it was a very lucky time to be involved in Australia's construction industry then.
It really was, wasn't it?
Yes.
So how many people worked for EPT at that time in the early 50s?
The numbers fluctuated, but it was continually growing because they not only went into television towers and power stations, they built bridges. As telecommunications spread around Australia, they built the vast majority of the Telstra network that we have now in Australia.
Okay.
So there were towers popping up on the horizon all over the country. Probably they went up to a couple of thousand people at one stage.
Significant, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you talk about the towers sort of popping up, and I said in my intro, they look like mini Eiffel Towers, you know. And the reason I say that as well is because when my parents got married, you know, the Italian tradition is to have a bomboniere, and they actually had little Eiffel Towers as their bomboniere, which I think my dad wanted not because we're French by any stretch, we're Italian, but because they reminded him of the towers of EPT.
That's right. Yeah.
So we've got these little Eiffel Tower or, you know, sort of EPT towers as their bomboniere from that day. I want to go back to the Olympics. So, you know, I just want to draw that really strong thread. So the Olympics were coming to Melbourne in 1956. Everyone wanted to, you know, this is the age of television. It's just the advent of television around the world and in Australia certainly. And so they wanted to be able to broadcast the games, right? So hence EPT had the contract to build the tower, and then everyone wanted to be watching it. So we had more towers being built so to connect Australia. Is that fair, or
that's
have
right.
I missed
all,
a step?
All over Australia, towers were popping up and slowly spread from the East Coast all the way to Western Australia. EPT did build towers in Western Australia in those early days of television. One of the towers was the ABC Tower down in the city, which was there till a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But also down all the way down to Mount Barker.
Yeah.
There's a huge tower down there that's still there today and still in operation. And that was built by EPT in 1966.
So it really was connecting the entire Australian landscape, wasn't it?
That's right.
You've got these electricity towers all connecting, and telecommunications towers, and, you know, just all of that capability that charged us forward.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it slowly spread over the whole country. In the wake of the television. Starting in Australia, then what was the Postmaster General's Department, which preceded Telecom, they started building their network, which spread all the way over Australia. And EPT built the vast majority of that network, which even traversed the Nullarbor. That last section that linked all the capital cities was completed in 1970, and that's the 58 towers that crossed the Nullarbor in the middle of nowhere, very difficult circumstances to work and live in. But EPT built it.
Yeah.
And those towers are still on the Nullarbor today.
So there's another little photo opportunity if anyone's driving across the Nullarbor is to take photographs of these towers that are still there.
You can't miss them. Every 50 kilometres, look on the horizon, they'll pop up.
So tell me about the living conditions, because that is harsh times and middle of nowhere. And a lot of these employees, a lot of these workers were from overseas. So probably not expecting these rugged conditions in Australia. I know my dad used to speak, you know, Papa used to speak about, you know, what he'd experienced and the hard work, the sweat. And I don't think he even had words to describe the difficulty that everyone faced on those times. But they did it with such joy because it was such mateship. I mean, there's so much in there that I'd love to unpack with you, Matthew. So tell me about the conditions.
I don't know what they expected when they arrived, because we're thinking, when you think about it, the war ending in 45 and only 6 years later EPT was started. At the time, the government had a policy which described Italians as enemy aliens.
Because we were against them in the war.
Yes, and there was still that suspicion. The first group was able to come to Australia on a special workers' visa specifically for that project, and their movements were controlled and observed because there was that suspicion still.
But we had prisoner of war camps here in WA for Italian people who'd been here for years and years, but they were put in the prisoner of war camps.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's no doubt across Australia.
Yeah, and a lot of those early pioneers that came with EPT, they were given an enemy alien passport, and when they moved from camp to camp, they had to go to the local post office and register their movement because the government wanted to know what they were up to. The first camps were tent camps, very primitive conditions, basically a clearing chopped out from the bush. Water was drawn from a cart and put into a tank. EPT had their own cooks they brought from Italy, their own chaplain who acted as a social worker.
That seems pretty progressive of an organisation to be doing that in those days.
Yes, it was. But I think they understood if these men were coming so far from home and being in a foreign country, they needed that level of support, almost on the same level as good Italian cooking.
Yeah,
so the cooks were very important.
Oh, they were, absolutely.
The projects wouldn't have been able to run without the cooks. The food was very high quality Italian cooking, and lots of it. And most of them, all the men still talk about those days.
Absolutely.
So I think coming from Italy, coming from very poor circumstances and living in these conditions, I think the Australians probably look at them and think, well, look at all these single men living in a tent in the bush. But they were happy. They were earning money. They felt like they were contributing to society, and many of them stayed and built their own lives in Australia and became Australian citizens, and they were very proud of what they were doing in their new country.
Oh, very much so. There was so much pride. And it's interesting, I was just having this conversation the other day with a friend. We're driving through, going to Rockingham, to where I grew up, and past the Kwinana Industrial Strip. And a lot of people sort of look at it with disdain, look at the industrial strip with disdain because it's a bit smelly, and there's, the environmental side of it, and absolutely, it's certainly come in leaps and bounds, but it depends which eyes you look at it.
That's right.
And my parents always looked at that as, they saw the industrial strip and they saw opportunity, they saw jobs, they saw a future for their family, because they came from a place where there just wasn't that. There wasn't the opportunity of industry. There wasn't the opportunity of bright economic future outside of, a village sort of setting. And so, the eyes that they looked at it with was like, wow, wonderful. Look what we've done for our family, actually being here so close to opportunity.
Yes, and I think EPT looked at Kwinana in the same light in 1951. There was never an idea to start an operation in Western Australia. The population wasn't big enough. It was too far from Sydney. There was never an idea to start an operation here, and that all came about by circumstance and the opportunities that Australia presented at the time.
So, what was that circumstance?
So in 1953, Australia EPT was constructing grain silos in Victoria. And at the time, the world cartel had been disrupted by Argentina that dumped an enormous load of grain onto the market at a lower price. And by the following year, Australia knew that a lot of grain was going to come on the market that they wouldn't be able to sell. So they were wondering, what are we going to do with all this grain that's coming in? We need to store it somewhere.
Their own grain, right, yes.
So the CBH in Western Australia found out about EPT building these silos in Geelong and contacted the office in Sydney and said, listen, this is our problem. We need a storage facility for about 5 million bushels, enormous amount of grain, and we need it built quickly before the next harvest. Can you help us out?
No pressure.
Well, EPT was very good at that. And they said, well, this is an opportunity. It's, even though it's so far away from Sydney, what can we do? And so very quickly they came up with a design. The steel was fabricated in Italy and shipped to Fremantle. In the meantime, a crew started on the ground at the site in Midland, built all the concrete base, and by the time that was ready, they were unloading steel at Fremantle, and the Midland silo started to rise from the horizon and change the local skyline forever until it was demolished in 2016.
So only quite recently it was demolished.
Yes.
So from 1953.
Yes.
Yeah, wow.
And that was the first project EPT built in Western Australia. They established a construction camp in Robinson Road. But once the project was finished, they packed up and returned to Sydney because EPT management didn't see a future for the company in Western Australia.
Which is quite funny now, isn't it? Sort of thinking back about all the things that EPT was then involved in and how Australia, well, Western Australia then sort of took off in regards to industry. Yeah.
EPT, I think, always viewed themselves strictly as a power line company.
Mm.
There was a company policy of limited diversification, but no, it was we build power lines, that's what we're good at, that we don't really want to venture too far from that. But interestingly, for that project in Midland, one of the bosses from Sydney had just arrived in Australia. His name was Giuseppe La Ginestra. He was a very interesting character. He was brought to Western Australia to start that project, and he was a visionary in many ways. He saw that there was a huge opportunity outside transmission lines, and so he was very early on, he wanted to start doing labour hire. Mm. He wanted to build things apart from transmission lines, and he was really the person who pushed EPT to diversify outside of transmission lines. And he saw that there was huge opportunity in Australia for that. So very quickly they started building blast furnaces in Port Kembla, Newcastle. They started building fabrication workshops outside of the Sydney workshop, so they established branches in Port Kembla, Newcastle, Whyalla, often on the back of the steel mills, until one day he heard about a project that was going to start in Western Australia in 1964, and that was the Hamersley Iron Ore Project.
Very significant for Western Australia.
Yes, yeah. And for EPT.
And for EPT, yeah. So tell me what happened then. So we're in 1964. We've heard that there's this thing called the Hamersley Iron Ore Project, which is going to come about in WA, in the northwest of Western Australia. And EPT's sort of put their hand up to be part of it.
Yes. Giuseppe La Ginestra managed to land the contract for EPT to provide the vast majority of the labour for that project. So I think at any stage they had about up to 1,500 men working on the project from anywhere involved in anything from digging holes, loading those holes with ammonia nitrate to blast, pouring concrete, and obviously erecting steel at the port facility in Dampier and the mine site at Tom Price. There was the initial job was kicked off from by a convoy that drove from Port Kembla that was headed by Mario Gandini, who very shortly afterwards was appointed Western Australia manager.
Yes.
They arrived on the beach at what was then known as King Bay. There was nothing there.
What's it known as now? I was trying to work out what that place was. Where is King's Bay now?
Well, that's Dampier.
That's Dampier, right. Yes. Okay, yes.
So they lived in tents on the beach. They built the service wharf to get the initial material and machinery on site because they couldn't, there was no other way to access the site. So they literally pushed boulders out into the bay, and slowly they worked their way up to about 1,500 men.
And my dad was one of them. Yeah, he definitely, all the words you've said there, you know, you've just peppered my childhood there. You know, you said Whyalla and Newcastle and Blast Furnace and Steel Mill and Dampier and Port Kembla, Tom Price, Dampier, Hammersley. They're all words of my childhood, you know, all the things my dad would talk about, and I'm only just joining the dots now.
Yes. Well, it was EPT also, the way it operated, it was an itinerant workforce. They were working in the middle of nowhere. This was a company run by Italians that only a few years earlier had been at war with Australia.
Yes.
EPT management was made up with many characters who had a fascist background. So there was that tension in the air as well, in the background, and they were, it wasn't a company that put themselves out there and advertised. They did things in very quietly, and they just got on with the job.
They just got on with it.
And so that's why you and I, we look back at those times and wonder, what were they up to? Because there's no records there. Very few records that exist.
Yeah.
They just got on with the job.
But you've made it your life's passion, in fact, Matthew, to go and find out the stories behind them all.
Yes, that's right. I think it's a really important story that needs to be documented, because so few of the men are left now.
Mm.
And if it's not documented within the next 10 or 20 years, there's a real risk that this great story will disappear.
It will be lost, yeah, absolutely. And that's where you and I first met, wasn't it, Matthew?
That's right.
I got this sort of very unexpected phone call one day, probably about, would it be 5 years ago, maybe?
Yes.
Yeah, 5 years ago you rang and wanted to know if I was related to Norberto Facin and if he had worked at EPT and whether I could share some of the story, because you were doing this research into EPT. And I must admit, I was a bit suspicious at first, thinking, how do you know this and what do you want to know? And then we met and I've been really enthralled and so inspired by what you're trying to do to help my family reconnect the stories too.
It's all connections. So I was in the Latrobe Valley probably 7 years ago and speaking to a wonderful gentleman there, Fred DiCipio, and he was telling me about a project EPT did in the late 60s for our COA. Down in Geelong, and he was telling me about one of the foremen there, your father.
Yeah.
And that's how our connection started.
It did, didn't it? That's right. And yeah, these memories and these stories of these men who worked together in all sorts of conditions, being very well fed. But you know, the mateship that they would talk about was really special.
Yeah, so it was one big family.
Mm,
mm. Maybe that most of them left their family behind in Italy, yeah. But they had a surrogate family, which was EPT.
Yeah, it was a very strong connection between the workers. You know, if any organisation's talking about culture now, EPT had an incredible culture.
That still remains in the next generation like us. We never work for the company, but we feel that connection.
Well, I remember it fondly. So EPT had a camp in Kwinana, so along the Kwinana strip there in Beach Road. There was Office Road?
Beach Road.
Beach Road, and Office Road is the next one down. So in Beach Road they had the EPT camp, and the men would stay there. So it had, it had a little, they're not dongers, it was built and it was like little rooms. It was almost like a little hotel, and then had the mess, which was the kitchen with the most incredible food. And in fact, people from around the other industries and the police officers would actually stop and have lunch with the EPT workers in the mess. It was well known in the strip, in the Kwinana Industrial Strip, about how good the food was there.
And the drinks.
And the drinks. Yeah, that was a whole other time, wasn't it? But then they had the La Cantina, you know, they had the canteen where they had the pool table, and they had the Chinotto, which I love, Chinotto, which is a very bitter Italian soft drink. And I would go with my mum to pick up my dad in the afternoons after school and after his work. And I'd, you know, race up as a child up to the La Cantina and, you know, my brother and I might play pool with the men who were living there, have a drink at the bar as in a soft drink. And we were very welcomed and felt really part of that whole family. You know, they loved seeing the children.
Yes. Yeah, many of the men there were single. They lived in the camp and, they adopted many of these children. The married men, their children would become godchildren. Definitely. Of these men, because they didn't have anyone else.
No, they didn't. Exactly. Yes. Right. And absolutely, my brother and I, our godparents are, you know, men from EPT. Yeah.
Quinana's an interesting story as well. It's that, again, that was never, it was never foreseen to start a fabrication facility so far from the east. But when they won the contract for Tom Price, they needed a holding facility to where the men could be brought, processed. They bought this block of land. La Ginestra actually bought the block of land. It was a pig farm at the time.
Oh, was it really?
Yes. Okay. And he was saying to manager, you know, we've got to get into Western Australia. There's a lot of opportunity there. There's these big projects starting. And the managing director, Dr. Oriola, was against this. And no, it's too far. There's not enough work. So La Ginestra went and bought the block in his own name. And then when it finally kicked off, there was this big rush on, you know, we've got to get a facility there. We've got to get a facility. And La Ginestra said, don't worry, I already bought the land.
I've got the pig farm, don't you worry.
And so they built the camp there with the kitchen. Pietro Gallo was the first cook.
Yes.
Followed by Lovro Stokovic.
Who I'm still in contact with, so I'll have to tell him we had a connection here. Yeah.
Fantastic guy.
Amazing. Fantastic man. And he then ran, many, many years later, ran the fish and chip shop in Rockingham.
That's
Beach.
Right.
Great cook. Yeah.
Great guy. And then in 1966, there was plans to build the blast furnace in Kwinana for Australian Iron and Steel. And EPT won a huge contract for that. So they built the first stage of a fabrication workshop to service that project. And from there, being in Kwinana offered other opportunities as well, because as we know, Kwinana was started for BP.
Yes.
Alcoa was there.
Yeah, that was the next one. So BP was the first. I think that was about 1962, 63, and then Alcoa shortly followed. Yeah.
So huge opportunities for diversification, which EPT pursued. Again, associated with what they were doing always with steel, but now the focus became piping.
And what about power? Because then there was the Muja power station they built, but that was more about the construction rather than the power aspect. Is that right?
There were two stages there. So just going back a little bit, in those early days, there was East Perth Power Station.
Mm.
There was South Fremantle Power Station. And there was a small grid that went around Perth. With the construction of Kwinana Power Station, a much bigger installation, there needed to be new infrastructure. So EPT won a small contract to basically connect South Fremantle to Kwinana Power Station and then build a small power line to the substation, which is known as Northern Terminal. But very quickly, that grew into a much larger project. The story is one afternoon, Dr. Oriola was in town and turned up to the office and said, I've got a new contract for you, which no one knew about. Huh. He'd made a handshake agreement with the Premier, and the original contract was extended to a much larger contract, which involved two huge 330 kV transmission lines which circled Perth. And it caused a lot of problems because, well, politically for Tonkin anyway, because...
So John Tonkin was the Premier with the handshake.
Yes, because it hadn't been put out to tender.
Oh.
But the deal was made with Oriolo because there was an issue with unemployment in Western Australia at the time. If EPT fabricated the steel here, EPT would be given the contract, and that's what happened. They set up, they extended the workshop, they set up a galvanizing plant, and the steel for that transmission line was fabricated in Kwinana.
And, of course, local employment, yeah? That yes. was part of the deal. Yeah. Yes. The future was set for EPT in Kwinana.
Yes. Yeah. Or further reinforced.
Further reinforced because yes. it was already there, yeah.
Because then they were building, they kept continuing to do work up north. So yeah, as the mine started, more mines started to be built, Parabadu, one of them, there was more work to be done there. So they won some contracts to build huge bridges up there for the railway line, crushing facilities. They provided labour services for the port facility up in for loading of the iron ore. When the Ord River Dam was built, they won a contract up there for a pipeline. And interesting thing out of that project, that was the beginning of a company called United Construction, which is now listed on the stock exchange. It was three EPT tradesmen took over the EPT contract as a subcontract, and that was the beginning of their adventure in business together. Another huge success story.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I think there are a couple of other huge success stories from ex-EPT people. So we've got Transfield.
Transfield was a big one.
Monadelphous.
Monadelphous, which came out of United as well.
Yeah.
In Perth, you have Fremantle Steel Fabrication. And then you look at the second generation companies that have come out of these companies, for example, Pacific Industrial Company.
Yes.
That was an offshoot from Transfield, even Fremantle Hire.
Yeah. So it really did. EPT was the pioneer of all of this, wasn't it?
Yeah, a lot of these companies that are around today that are especially involved in steel fabrication erection, if you look deep enough, they have the EPT DNA.
Yeah, I like that, the EPT DNA, most definitely. And in fact, another very interesting part of Western Australia's landscape, which has got the EPT DNA, is the antenna array at the Northwest Cape in Exmouth.
Yes.
Tell me the history of that.
That's being a sort of US military base with spying capabilities. There's not a lot of information about it, but
haven't been able to dig that one out.
No, it's been quite difficult. EPT was definitely involved. This is a big antenna array facility that was used during the Cold War. EPT was definitely involved in building the towers. At the time, they were the tallest structures in Australia.
Is that right? Yeah.
EPT was involved. To what extent, I don't know.
And what about the Carnarvon satellite dish? Is that still part of that?
Well, that was built by EPT. It was fabricated in Sydney and shipped over and erected. It has a sibling satellite dish in Ceduna in South Australia that were built at the same time. But that was the erection crew came from Western Australia, headed by Peter Kavasin, a long-term, highly capable steel erector.
And my godfather.
Oh, and your godfather.
And my godfather. There you go.
He was a pioneer of EPT. He came in 1952, I think. Long-term employee. He was highly skilled at difficult erection projects, and he was in charge of the erection of those two projects.
Is that so?
Yes.
Okay, so that was the Carnarvon satellite dish and the Northwest Cape.
Yes.
Yeah, in Exmouth. And the satellite dish, is that part of the Global Communications Satellite System, and it has a NASA link?
Yes, that was in the 60s. Well, we're talking about Cold War era, and obviously the space race has a deep connection to that. The global community was looking to set up a global communications system, and that facility formed part of that, and it was also used by NASA for the moon landings, my understanding is telecommunications, but also telemetry.
So interesting, and, you know, something that we wouldn't otherwise know had you not been doing all of this research, Matthew.
It's a great story. But again, these were built by EPT, this itinerant workforce working out in the middle of nowhere. Living in tents or caravans or huts, very difficult circumstances. They went out to these jobs, built them, and then moved on to the next job. And really, apart from the structures themselves, they didn't leave any other evidence of their presence in these places.
And it's a really interesting part of Australia's history, because alongside all of this, so you've got Australia needing to have all of this infrastructure built, doesn't have the expertise or the people power here in its own country, so brings in a whole lot of expertise and a whole lot of men predominantly to do this very heavy work and important work. And Australia continues to grow and needs to keep growing, and we need to keep the workforce here. So a little known policy, I guess, of Australia's history is that in the late 50s and early 60s, they actually then went, Australia went overseas knowing that they needed to keep the European men here, the Italian men and the men from what was Yugoslavia at the time, now Croatia and Serbia, and men
Spanish,
from
Portuguese,
Greeks, all of these beautiful, rich cultures. And they needed to keep these men here. And the Australian women didn't want to marry European men, and European men didn't typically want to marry Australian women. There was still this real cultural divide, most definitely, at that time. And so the Australian government knew that they needed to keep these men here in Australia, and so needed to bring women in from Europe to be here, so there's a potential of men marrying and staying here and having their families here instead of then going back to their own country to marry and continue their lives there. And so that is the other part of my family story, Matthew, is that in 1960, my mother was one of those women who was able to come to Australia on this migration opportunity, because they were only looking for women at that time to come and start a life here in Australia. And so she was able to come at the age of 20 after begging my grandmother to allow her to come, because she had the opportunity to potentially then sponsor her brothers to come out to Australia to work, which happened. But, you know, there's this interesting connection with migration and the building of Australia with these new cultures and races and foods and everything that went around that time.
Yes. And I think, in terms of the EPT story, the partners and wives don't get their fair mention for the roles they played. Yes, the men were out there with, you know, getting all the glory and building these huge structures, but they were away from home.
Yeah.
The partners and wives kept the families together, kept the household running. It was very hard for them, because a lot of their husbands were away for long periods of time, and they were all alone. Often they didn't have the language, and they felt socially isolated, but they did an incredible job to raise their families. You're listening to My Warm Table podcast. My name's Matthew Kwame, and my conversation with Sonia is all about the history of electric power transmission.
Matthew, I'm so enjoying our Tavola Calda conversation this morning, and it really is a trip down memory lane for me. And also, you know, we are sitting around the warm table here at my home, and the lovely sounds of the neighbourhood are also joining our conversation, with dogs barking and the guy across the road deciding to start the lawnmower. But it all sort of evokes a time and place, and I want to take us back to the 1970s and what was happening for EPT in that time.
EPT was very busy building transmission lines on the East Coast. There was some diversification into Southeast Asia. But then, you know, world events.
When you say diversification into Southeast Asia, where do you mean?
New Zealand, Vietnam.
Did they ever
Thailand,
go to Port Moresby?
Lots of work in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, because I'm sure my dad talked about Port Moresby and being there.
Yes. They spent a lot of time working in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
Sergio Bazzoni from Queensland was the main character involved in those projects there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so 1970s, so they're diversified across the region, if you like. Yeah.
Yes. With a presence almost in every state. But you know, world events changed the or offered more opportunities for the future, the energy crisis being a big one.
So tell me about the energy crisis of the 70s.
So that resulted in a run of power station construction all across the country, and EPT having very big fabrication workshops was ideally situated to take advantage of that. In Western Australia, the issue was even more acute, being isolated from the rest of the country and not being connected to the national grid. The state had to generate and distribute all its electricity. So one of the first initiatives was to extend the Muja power station in Collie, where the coalfields are.
Yes.
So EPT won numerous contracts there for fabrication and erection of power station structural steel, and then resulting from this new generating plant, new power lines were required. So EPT won the contract to construct a 330 kV power line from Muja to Northern Terminal. Mm. But also at the same time, the government realised that they needed to do more than this. And Woodside was already doing exploration up in the Pilbara for oil and gas. And this period of time coincided with the beginning of the Northwest Shelf.
So that's a significant time in Western Australia's development, industrial development, I should say. And so Northwest Shelf with Woodside being involved in that?
Yes.
Yeah, back in the 1970s. Okay, so EPT had a story there too.
Yes. So the it was a huge deal to put together to come up with something that was financially viable. Mm. Being so far from Perth and in such an isolated place, how was Woodside going to make this work? So what made it come together was an agreement to sell gas to Japan. And was able to underwrite the whole project. So it was broken up into two stages. The first stage was a domestic supply of gas to Perth. So there was a huge pipeline built from Karratha to south of Perth, and that really underpinned Western Australia's ability to generate enough energy for itself.
I think that was underwritten by Alcoa, wasn't it? The pipeline.
It went to Alcoa.
Alcoa.
But for such a long pipeline in traversing an isolated landscape, it needed to be controlled. So there was a series of guy mast towers built along the line, and EPT won the contract to fabricate and erect those towers. The North Wales Shelf was a turning point in the Australian construction industry in terms of welding standards, safety standards. It really changed the future of construction in Australia. And there was a meeting organised in Perth towards the late 70s where the local contractors were invited to come to this talk. And though it was explained that, yes, they might have the capability to do welding and fabrication, but this was a completely different project. They would need to team with experienced contractors from overseas who already done this work before. There was a lot of cryogenic work, type of welding that had never been done in Australia. So when the LNG plant kicked off, there were two what they call trains.
Yes.
And for local contractors to be involved, they had to partner with experienced firms from overseas. At the time, Italy had a long history of this type of work. Saipem was one of the companies that had built pipelines, had built oil rigs, had done all these type of projects around the world. And another one was based in Bologna, it was called Focchi. So EPT formed a joint venture with Focchi to build one of the trains for the LNG plant, and that was a huge project. And that was another market that EPT branched out into.
So diverse. This company was so diverse, and the skills of these men was just so expansive, wasn't it?
Yes.
Incredible. Yeah. So the 1970s heralded the real, not the start, but the embedding and consolidation of a lot of these industries as, look, this is definitely where Western Australia's future lies, you know. So let's put in this infrastructure, let's explore these vast areas, and industry was really thriving as it was setting up in those days,
And the industry was maturing. There was a consciousness of about safety, which didn't exist before.
Definitely.
And I think EPT got caught up in this change a little bit. They didn't embrace the change to the extent that I think they should have. Talking about this decade, these two decades, the 70s and 80s, where all these huge power stations were built, and obviously from that there was a run of transmission lines, and EPT built the majority of them. But by the time we're drawing towards the late 1980s, there were no transmission lines that needed to be built anymore. EPT started to found itself in trouble. They had this huge, highly qualified and loyal workforce that they were finding, which was difficult to service now because there just wasn't the work there.
Mm.
And very quickly the company found itself in trouble. We have to remember that it was a subsidiary of a multinational with headquarters in Milan, but for financial reasons based in Switzerland. Decisions made in Europe impacted on what happened in Australia. The order book dropped overnight. The amount of work that was coming in was vastly reduced, and 1 year they lost. The company made a huge loss. So, looking at the company from Italy, thinking, well, what are we going to do here? There's not that many power lines to be built anymore. We have other operations around the world. We've done well out of this company. And slowly the decision was made to shut down the company. The parts of the company that were making money remained, but this huge workforce was dismantled. Many men were forced into retirement prematurely.
Yes.
They weren't ready to retire.
No.
They loved their job.
Yeah.
And many of them got left behind. A lot of the camps were used for rehabilitation for single men that didn't have a home to go to. And when these camps were closed down, they had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
It's a very sad period in the company's history.
But let's just cast our mind back then to the legacy it did leave. So across Australia, it left the legacy of the telecommunications tower joining this vast, remarkable, harsh landscape all the way from, you know, the New South Wales coast, if you like, all the way across up to Western Australia and to Hammersley and the Northwest Shelf. So right, joining this country from a telecommunications aspect in all senses, from TV, so when the advent of television and the advent of microwave and broadband. So, you know, EPT's got its little DNA peppered all across the landscape in that, And then diversifying into building grain silos and blast furnaces and creating the industry that we know here in Western Australia through a lot of the companies that we still know and are going strong, like Alcoa and BP and Hammersley Iron Ore and the Muja Power Station, which, you know, like as I said earlier, is about to go into this next phase of transformation for power and electricity.
Yeah. And now we're seeing another new run of transmission lines being built in Australia, and you look at the next, EPT missed out on the mobile phone tower network. We're talking about wind turbines now. EPT had the expertise to diversify in those markets. And it was a question of, you know, what might have been. But it was a great story while it lasted. And so I think if it was still around today, would we be talking here?
Well, that's right. We wouldn't. Yeah. We would be taking it for granted.
Yes.
So that leads me to the obvious question then, Matthew. What has inspired you to capture the history and to speak, you know, sit at the tavola calda of many EPT alumni, if you like, and hear their stories? What underpins your inspiration?
I'm an architect, and a few years ago I was going back into my memory wondering about why I chose that line of work. And I remember as a child growing up hearing EPT all the time and wondering, you know, what that meant. So just out of curiosity, I started trying to find information about the company. And to my surprise, I couldn't find anything. I thought that was really strange. It's such a big company. And that was my impression of it from my childhood memories. And I thought, this is very strange that I can't find anything. So I wanted, that's where the search began. And I found someone who worked for the company, and I asked if I could come and talk to him about it. He said, "Yeah, sure. What do you want? What would you like to know?" And I said, "I don't know."
Yeah, that's right. I don't know it. I don't know.
And so I went and saw this gentleman, and he pulled out a shoebox of black and white photographs with transmission line towers, and he gave me the number of someone else, and they showed me their photos, and slowly, this story gathered momentum until the point where I thought, this story needs to be documented.
Mm.
And so now I've travelled all around Australia trying to find these people to try and document their stories, try to preserve the history of EPT. There's people in every state. Despite the company closing, the friendships have endured. There are reunions on the East Coast. People still get together for lunch in Fremantle. They're still great friends, and they love reminiscing about those times together.
So, Matthew, you're writing a book about EPT.
Yes.
With all of the history and all of the stories and times that you've spent in state libraries and archives and, you know, trying to unravel all of the history, piecing it all together. How's the book coming along?
It's slowly coming, getting there. It's been very hard to find information, especially about the beginning of the company. So it's been, a lot of it has involved talking to people and saying, what do you remember from this time? And then talking to someone else and seeing how those stories align, because we're talking about events that happened 70 years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
The founders are long gone from the company. And so slowly, the story is coming into existence. I think for a long time I didn't know if I'd be able to find all the information, but now I'm well along the path, and eventually I will publish a book about the history of EPT, where I put all these stories together.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm just very sad that, you know, my papa wasn't around to tell you his stories, because, he would have loved to have met you, Matthew, and to have shared, many glasses of red wine, I suspect, maybe on his part, to tell you the stories of EPT, because he definitely was one of those loyal, hardworking men who loved the company, just yes. Loved it.
And people have told me that, so he's earned his place in there. So that's... That's what's going to happen. He's already in there.
Oh, can't wait to read it. I can't wait to read it.
And so has everyone else. Everyone that I've spoke to, I try and find their place in the story where, you know, they really shine. And so I want to mention as many people as possible, because they're the people that built this company. And thanks to them, we have this great story.
Yeah.
I was too young to remember any of this. So my father stopped working for EPT after my birth. So I didn't grow up with it like you didn't, being able to go to the camp.
Mm.
But it's had a huge influence on my life regardless.
And it's had a huge influence on Australia.
So yes.
It's certainly a story worth capturing and for us all to read and acknowledge.
Yes.
Mm. Matthew, I have so enjoyed our Tavola Calda warm table conversation today. You've, evoked so many memories from my childhood. You've sort of coloured in the landscape of some of my father's work and his DNA, which is in the DNA of so much of Western Australia. I started getting emotional. I'm going to end being emotional. What you're capturing is significant for Western Australia. It's significant for Australia and for so many migrants. So I just want to say thank you for for taking the time, because this is of your own time. You're certainly not getting paid for the work and research you're getting, or maybe you're getting paid in calories with all the beautiful food that you're enjoying around the Tavola Calde. But yeah, Matthew, thank you so much for joining me and for reaching out to me those years ago to connect the story of my family.
Thank you, Sonia. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for joining me, Sonia Nolan, around the Warm Table. Let's grow the community. Please follow my Warm Table podcast on socials and like and share this episode with your family and friends. My Warm Table is brought to you by Females Over 45 Fitness. Keep listening now for a health tip from FOF head coach Kelly Riley.
Hi ladies, it's Kelly here, creator and head coach of Females Over 45 Fitness. Memory retention. Brain fog. How are you going with it? Here at FOF, we really help you improve your memory retention, okay? Because especially with the boxing, there is a lot of number sequences which really helps you with that memory issue. So we change the sequences all the time, so you're constantly having to think. So for ladies that have memory or brain fog issues, FOF is the perfect place for you to come along. You get out there boxing and it really does help your memory. Ladies, it's your time to shine. Let's get out there.